ಪಂಜಾಬಿಹಾರಿ Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna. Welcome to our Sunday evening discussion. And tonight I thought we would discuss the topic of happiness, technology, and society. In one sense, the USA has changed a great deal since 1950. The gross national product has tripled. People have so many things that would be considered luxuries previously. Now they're considered essentials. Jet plane travel, telephones, all these things are considered just parts of normal life. Yet, has the sense of happiness increased? The study of happiness, in terms of the academic community, goes as far back as basically 1946. This is when the first reliable studies of the happiness index, however conceived, were introduced. Now, there has been huge economic expansion since 1950, but has there been an expansion in happiness? This is an essential point to consider. And the statistics show that although there has been such mighty economic expansion, the people's sense of their own happiness has not increased at all. In fact, since the 1970s, academics have noticed even what could be taken as a decrease in the happiness that people report they have. So this is very surprising because generally, people identify happiness with wealth and economic prosperity. Of course, people will say money can't buy everything, but then they'll add, but it can buy most things that you need. And those things that you need that money can't buy, well, at least you can rent them. So it seems to be taken for granted that there is some implicit connection between wealth and happiness. I remember when I was a young lad, my mother taught me a mantra, and she told me to always remember it. I was just about 5 years old. She taught me this mantra, "Romance without finance is a nuisance." I said, "Son, always remember this." Well, somehow or other, due to my calling in life, I never had a chance to apply that advice. For the past, 35 years, I've been living the life of a renunciate or a monk. The point is that people have these assumptions, these kind of cultural assumptions, that the more economic expansion there is, the more economic prosperity there is, the more, at least, there's the chance for happiness. Now, try to understand that generally people conclude poverty is misery, but wealth increases your options, and therefore your happiness should increase because you have the wherewithal to explore various avenues at your discretion. That's why you have the phrase discretionary income. It makes you really feel wholesome and secure when you can apply that phrase to yourself. I have discretionary income. Income that will be at my discretion for spending. I can deploy it in whatever way I like and bring myself fulfillment. Now, what academics have noted is that looking over the past 5 decades or so, since the 1950s, once people reach the middle class level, an increase in wealth does not bring about any measurable or noticeable increase in happiness. And in fact, latest studies show that the more choices people have in terms of how to spend their money, the more anxiety they take on. One famous study was done in which people would go to a supermarket, and there on a table were, one table were 24 types of jam at a sale price, a very abnormally low price, because the whole point was to make an academic study, so therefore they put the jam at a very low price, and 24 different types on one table. And then on the other table, there were just 6 types of jam at a very low price. And the table with only 6 types of jam far outsold the table with 24 types. Because people became bewildered by so many alternatives, and indeed they became a little bit anxiety-ridden. Oh, which one? This one, that one, this one, that one. But those people who went to the table with just 6, they had less stress because there weren't so many options to consider. Now, this phenomenon of a lack of correlation between economic expansion and happiness can be seen not only in the USA, but also in other societies, developed nations. Take, for example, Japan. Up until the 1960s, Japan was known as a country producing cheap goods, cheap electronic goods. I remember as a little boy in the 50s, If you got something that said made in Japan, you just considered it was going to be a cheap throwaway. Then, sometime around 1960, that all changed. And by the time 1980 came, Japan was the world's most high-tech nation. And their gross national product for Japan quintupled, went up by 5. Yet, the studies of the people's happiness in Japan revealed that the happiness has not gone up at all. It's remained the same. So now, in the 21st century, there is a sense of wonder. What's going on? If there is no significant correlation between economic expansion and getting more wealth and your own happiness, then maybe what's the point to it all? Another interesting factor to take into account is that the happiest people in the USA, according to the standard happiness surveys and tests that are given to everyone, the happiest people turn out to be the Amish in Pennsylvania, who forego most of the technological innovations we take for granted. They turn out to be the happiest people with the least amount of depression. Now, naturally, you have to factor in other variables, like they have a strong sense of community, family stability, so on and so forth. But anyway, just taking things in a surface way, shall we say, they are the happiest people in the USA, and they have not bought in to the wealth race or the technology race. So all these things should make us think. Maybe we have jumped into a race which is not at all constructive for ourselves, not at all beneficial. When we talk about Krishna consciousness, which is the contemporary equivalent of the ancient Vedic culture of India, we're talking about a culture that values mastery over the self as the first priority in life. Someone who can master their mind and senses is known as a wealthy person. This is the Krishna conscious sociological contribution, based on the ancient Vedic texts of India, based on the ancient Vedic way of culture and society. Before anyone sets out to do anything according to this kind of culture, first you have to have mastery over yourself, power over yourself before power over others. We can get a lot of insight into that kind of philosophy in terms of our current events today. What is more valuable in life? To have the power to vote, to have the power to spend, but you have no power over yourself. From the ancient Vedic perspective, as presented in texts, spiritual texts like Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, if you have no mastery over yourself, if you have no power over yourself, then your power to vote and your power to spend is meaningless. What do you think? Sounds very severe? Well, what is our contemporary standard? If you've got the power to vote, if you've got the power to spend, then everything else will work out. Just feel fortunate to live in what are called the established market democracies. And then things will work out. You may not know who you are. You may not know why you're here. And certainly, controlling the mind, controlling the senses, that doesn't sound like fun at all. But you can vote and you can spend. So, everything must be all right. Now, the contribution that Krishna consciousness is trying to make is that same contribution presented by the ancient Vedic knowledge and culture of India, that first have power over yourself. First, be able to control your mind and senses, and then you may seek to do something for others, to do something for the world. There's a famous verse in the fifth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the postgraduate study to Bhagavad Gita. No one should become a spiritual teacher, a mother, a father, husband, wife, if that person cannot teach his or her dependents how to become free from the cycle of repeated birth and death, the wheel of samsara, life after life, birth after birth, death after death. If you cannot extricate your dependent from material existence, then don't take responsibility for others. Which leads us to another subject matter we often discuss here. If you truly want to love, if you truly want to care for others, you must become qualified. The whole world is full of people who want to love and want to care, but have no qualification to do so. To love and to care is a great responsibility. You have to know what you're doing. For example, if you go to a doctor or a lawyer, you expect that person, that doctor or lawyer, to be qualified to be able to help you. You don't choose a doctor or lawyer by going around and seeing, well, do you give me a kind of a warm, fuzzy feeling in my heart? And has my body temperature gone up? Well, then I guess you're the one. No, you look and see, does that person have qualification? So, what is the use of our trying to love and care for others if we don't know what we're doing? In other words, if we have no qualification. Looked at from the ancient Vedic perspective, qualification begins with mastery over your own mind and senses. We would say, from the Krishna conscious viewpoint, that the problem of the world is not the quantity of the population, it's the quality of the population. If you change the quality of the population, then the quantity of people on this planet is no problem at all. In other words, the actual burden that the earth is feeling is the presence of hordes of unqualified persons without qualification. It takes qualification just to live, what to speak of, to reach out and love and care for others. So the first step in becoming qualified is to have power over yourself. This makes political science quite straightforward. If I have no power over my mind and senses, how can I put myself forward as a leader? In other words, there's no need to discuss who wields national power, who wields international power, who wields economic power. If the question of self-mastery has not been answered, this makes life much more simple, but not in some kind of restrictive way. No, this is expansion. This is liberating, that before I set out to do something, I first learn to control my own mind and senses. Then you can be said to be free. Now, often we hear about how people can be so easily manipulated. You pander to their lower desires. You entertain them. And then they'll agree to whatever you want. I was talking once with a former Prime Minister of New Zealand. That's where I'm based. And he was revealing to me what he and his fellow political leaders were contemplating. He began to talk to me because he was about to fly off to Yale University to give the commencement address there, and he had found out that I had graduated from Yale University, so he was very interested. He said, "My boy, how is it? You're a Yale graduate and you're practicing this Krishna consciousness." So I just told him, I said, "Well, it was quite obvious to me it was the smartest thing to do." He said, "Oh, well, tell me about it." I said, "Well, I have some questions for you before I tell you about myself. What is your vision for what's happening in your nation? And I assume that you are in touch with other national leaders. Is there some kind of collective understanding or trading of ideas and concepts going on?" Looked at me. "Young man." Actually, he's just like 5 years older than me, but somehow he thought I was very young. "So, young man, of course there is. And I don't expect you to bother me with talk about conspiracies and so on. It's just a matter of ordinary dealings that birds of a feather flock together. Those who have an interest in thinking of society, they trade ideas." So he began to explain to me how various concepts were being tried in the world. He told me, you know, New Zealand is like a laboratory. And we're trying things here that may be tried in other parts of the world. He said, "You know, there used to be a time when we political leaders thought there could be a danger of revolution. But we don't think that anymore. Along came television and just saved the day." "All we need to do is give people more and more television channels and they're pacified." Actually, in New Zealand, they didn't have any television until 1967. And you can see the great difference in the adults who were young during those years before there was TV. They told me what they would do after a day of farm work. They would just go into their living room and everyone would have books. They'd just take a book off the shelf, one of the classics, and just read. The whole family would just read together. That was considered normal. So even now, in New Zealand, you'll find, for those who are over 40 years old, that they may be farmers, they may be merchants, but they've read all the classics and so on and so forth, because there was nothing else for them to do when they were young. Now that has all changed, because even in a remote place like New Zealand, last stop before the South Pole, American TV is there to enliven and enlighten everyone. And this has changed the young people very much. So anyway, this former prime minister, who was about to fly off to Yale University to make the commencement address, he told me, "We don't worry about the people getting upset. We just can give them channel after channel on their television and more sports. Everything will be fine." So I kind of looked at him. I said, "Well, this is not very encouraging to hear." And he, in turn, said to me, "My boy, young man, look, if you have the vision to realize that there's something higher than living like this, just watching TV and sports, then become a controller. Become one of us. Otherwise, just stay like everyone else. Have your TV, have your sports. Be happy. If you're one of those rare ones who realizes this is not the kind of life I want, in other words, I want power. I want to be in control. Then become one of us. You know? But there's not going to be that many of such persons, he told me. Most everyone will be satisfied with their television, their sports. We're going to increase the number of sports teams, increase the number of TV channels. That'll take care of everyone. So, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking that this sounds very manipulative, very condescending. Young man, he said, try to understand. Someone has to be in control. Someone has to be in charge. If you're smart enough to see through all of this, become one of us. We're open. Otherwise, just take your TV and sports and don't worry about it. Yes, he said, I used to be a bit moral about all this in my younger days. But I've realized that, you know, people are the way they are. They just want to enjoy and be happy. And so we give them enjoyment. We give them happiness. And we go on with our affairs of running everything. Oh, he told me a lot of other things like that. So I began to think that now more than ever, people need to receive the timeless wisdom that unless they have mastery over themselves, they're always going to be manipulated and exploited. The advantage of the Krishna conscious lifestyle, this spiritual lifestyle, which forms the essence or foundation of ancient Indian social culture, the advantage is that because you are spiritually established internally, you cannot be manipulated from without. In Sanskrit, this is called the Brahma-Bhuta platform of life. This terminology comes from a verse spoken by Lord Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, Brahma-Bhuta prasanatma nasochati nakangshati samat sarveshu bhuteshu madbhaktim labhate param. That ancient Sanskrit verse contains a vastness of wisdom. If you want to be a truly valuable human being, first of all, you have to understand and experience your identity as separate from the body and the mind. There's a real challenge for you. You have to have firm realization that your identity is non-material. You can actually experience the core of your identity as separate from biological and mental fluctuations. In this way, you have a chance for true happiness. In other words, true happiness is not dependent on material adjustments, material changes. True happiness is based on something completely different, your non-material identity, your spiritual identity, as a core particle of spiritual consciousness. This is the ancient Vedic wisdom. So, first, you must have this spiritual realization of your non-material identity. Not just talk like, hey, I'm spiritual, you're spiritual, you know. Not just cheap talk like that, but actual experience. Laboratory experience. And in this way, your happiness is actually substantial and not just fleeting, appearing and disappearing from moment to moment. So then, what's next? Nasochati nakangshati, the Sanskrit says. You are not hankering for things that you imagine you need, and you're not lamenting for things that you're losing, which you thought were so crucial for your life. And samat sarveshu bhuteshu, you see all living entities as equal because they're all spiritual entities wearing different kinds of material dresses, material coverings. So the body may be different. the human's body is different from the cow's body or the bird's body or so on and so forth. But the equality is there as a particle of spiritual consciousness. Therefore, a genuine human being doesn't unnecessarily eat of the food chain in such a way that unnecessary pain is caused. You sustain your life in such a way that minimizes the pain and suffering caused to other creatures. What is the reason? You understand the qualitative equality of all living entities, even though the bodies are different. Now, for someone who is established on this Brahma-Bhuta platform, this platform of true spiritual experience, such a person cannot be manipulated. Such a person is not subject to consumerist urges and exploitation. In other words, such a person can be trusted. How can you trust someone who can easily be bedazzled, exploited, manipulated by appeals to the uncontrolled mind and senses? You need this, you need that. Wouldn't you really rather have this? Everyone else has that. What about you? If you have a whole society of persons who cannot control their mind and senses, such persons are easily manipulated, easily exploited. And therefore, how can there be any true peace and prosperity? There'll obviously be all kinds of scams going on. There'll obviously be so much boom and bust because you're not dealing with people who are grounded. You're dealing with persons who can easily be played with because the persons can't control their own mind and senses. So like the former Prime Minister of New Zealand was telling me, don't blame us. We're just dealing with the realities. The people are like that. So we're just, making the best out of the situation. The people want to be manipulated. The people want to, they want to be pandered to. And a few persons want to be in control. So if you want to join our club, it's open to you. No discrimination. But don't put guilt trips on us. We're just doing the best we can. Someone's got to be in control. And we've just figured out where the people are at and what they want, and we give it to them. And there's social stability. Isn't that what it's all about? Social stability, which leads to economic prosperity, which leads to happiness, right? Wrong. Here's the problem. As we said, statistics show that economic expansion has not led to happiness. There's no measurable difference. For example, in the USA, there's been no measurable difference in the level of happiness in spite of the gross national products having tripled in 50 years. In Japan, the gross national product quintupled in 20 years. No change in happiness. And then, on the flip side of the coin, you got something else coming up. Mental depression. In the past 50 years in the USA, the levels of mental depression, the reports of mental depression, have been tenfold. Now, obviously, people have become more and more conscious about reporting and diagnosing mental illness. That's true. Still, we cannot dismiss such an extraordinary increase, tenfold in mental depression. And the World Health Organization tells us that very soon, within at least 10 years, you're going to see mental depression as the number two disease in the world behind heart disease. And that's in developed countries, the established market democracies. Now, We pay attention to all this information in Krishna consciousness because we are dedicated to giving people the highest benefit. What is that highest benefit? First, know what yourself is and then have mastery over yourself and then proceed to help others, to care for others, to love others. Once you have mastery over your own mind and senses, then you are able to vote properly and spend properly. In other words, you're able to have a decent human civilization. Now, how are we going to understand what is the self and have mastery over the self? The big question is, are we matter or are we something beyond matter? According to the latest scientific breakthroughs, there can be brain imagery. And in color, you can see so much activity going on in the brain. Some even say that with brain imagery, you can see the seat of the will, the seat of the passions. Now, what is the scientific explanation for what is the will? What to speak of the seat of the will? But even if you are, even if you want to say you're actually seeing the seat of the will through brain imagery technology, still, you're only seeing circumstantial evidence. You haven't caught the criminal himself. It's like someone has burglarized your home, and the police come to investigate, and they see maybe a shoe belonging to the criminal. They see a hat. They might even see fingerprints. But the person who did the criminal deed is nowhere to be found. So similarly, you may see so much activity in the brain. You may be able to see this change in the neurochemistry of the brain, that change. But to say that you have actually got your fingers on some kind of self that is responsible for all these changes, no, you cannot say that. There's no scientific proof whatsoever that consciousness is composed of chemicals. Some say, in the future, we'll show that. Others say, it's one of those great mysteries that may never be solved. In any case, we take our information straight from Lord Krishna, the Supreme Consciousness. That has some advantages, you know. If there's a Supreme Consciousness and you take your information from there, you can save yourself a lot of trouble. Now, in Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna presents himself as the Supreme Consciousness, but he just doesn't say, I am the Supreme Consciousness, believe it. That's all, folks. No. Lord Krishna says, I am the Supreme Consciousness, and here are the techniques for verifying that I am the Supreme Consciousness. Now, this sounds very fair. In Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna is presenting the laboratory. I have to be careful. Usually I say laboratory, but laboratory. You walk into this laboratory of bhakti yoga, the yoga of transcendental love and devotion for the Supreme, and you apply your senses. You take up the techniques, the methodology, and you get the result. You can verify through purified experience the existence of the Supreme Consciousness. This is a fair deal, isn't it? Nowhere in Bhagavad Gita do you find Lord Krishna saying, just believe what I say and call it a day. Everywhere in Bhagavad Gita, you find Lord Krishna saying, I am the Supreme Consciousness. Here are the steps that you can take to verify that for yourself. So this is the philosophical foundation of Krishna conscious knowledge. We understand by taking information from the Supreme Consciousness. Then it's easy also to understand your own individual consciousness. Just like when the sun rises in the morning, not only can you see the sun, but you also see yourself. So self-realization and Krishna consciousness go hand in hand. Realization of your tiny individual self and realization of the Supreme Self go hand in hand. But none of these tremendous breakthroughs can be achieved unless we have power over our own mind and senses. The laboratory research work into the nature of our own consciousness and the consciousness of the Supreme, that requires a very peaceful, calm, precisely controlled mind. So this is another contribution that the Krishna conscious culture is making to the world. Your conscious behavior has an enormous effect on what you can understand. It's not that you can act and behave in any way you like, and meanwhile your intellect functions flawlessly, and you can grasp anything and understand anything. No. From the ancient Vedic point of view, this characteristic of your level of consciousness affecting what you can understand, this is called state-specific knowledge. Very important. According to your state of consciousness, that determines what you can understand. If your consciousness is unclear, unpurified, then although you may get high scores on your university exams, still you won't be able to understand very deep and profound things about existence. Therefore, we would say the best culture, the best society, is one based on principles of purifying the consciousness, distilling the consciousness. And then there can be a clarity, there can be a lucid vision of where you should go as an individual and where society should go. But as long as people have no mastery over their mind and senses, what are they going to achieve? What are they going to attain? They'll just be continuously chase the hope that money will bring happiness, more wealth will make me feel more fulfilled. And meanwhile, you see depression increasing, frustration increasing, stress increasing. Some people are starting to wonder, maybe this pursuit of happiness is not getting us where we want to be. And in our Krishna conscious society, the kind of culture that we are presenting here, yes, we would definitely agree. The pursuit, the race for happiness can't be won. And now, statistics are bearing that out. Although the gross national product has soared, although economic expansion has soared, technological proliferation is everywhere, the people's happiness has not changed in any measurable way. And simultaneously, the depression problem, the mental depression problem, is expanding rapidly. We want to have the social and cultural values of being honest to ourselves. If I can't deal with myself, if I don't know who I am, how can I be of any value to myself, or how can I have any value for others? That is why the first injunction, the first philosophical command in Vedic culture is Atato Brahma Jigyasa. This Sanskrit mantra means first you become self-realized. You use your advanced human consciousness to inquire what is the ultimate truth. And then everything else follows from that. We feel that there would be the greatest benefit for society as a whole if society as a whole would take a deep look at these fundamental issues of human existence. As long as you cannot control your own mind and senses, you're wide open for exploitation and control. You're wide open for frustration and stress. And certainly, we have to understand, what is the nature of the self? Am I material or am I not? There should be a massive focus upon this issue, rather than just mentioning it on the side. Let us deal with the nature of the self, the nature of consciousness. Does consciousness have a chemical composition? Is the self simply a neurochemical phenomenon that emerges from the neurons in the brain? We have to look at these issues very deeply. And once we understand the nature of the self, then we can erect proper goals for the self. And of course, we'll also feel inspired to have mastery over our own mind and senses, rather than just live in a culture in which our mind and senses are dragged this way and that way, under a barrage all the time of sensory stimuli. And you're always feeling a state of need. I need this, I need that, I have to have this, I have to have that. I acquire these possessions, I acquire these relationships. People acquire even relationships now, just like they're objects off the shelf. There'll always be this insatiable hunger for more and more because there's no training in how to control the mind and senses. So we would say that real human culture begins with mastery over the self, mastery over one's mind and senses, and experiential insight into the true nature of the self, rather than just religious belief and religious theory. Then, after you've dealt with all those things, you can start to think about happiness. This is an enormous agenda, I admit. But we feel that it's the only way forward if you're going to be honest. So once again, please remember the verse from Srimad Bhagavatam. Don't take up any position of responsibility unless you can say to your dependent, for whom you're taking responsibility, that I can enlighten you with the knowledge and understanding so that you'll be free from illusion. You'll be free from the cycle of repeated birth and death, the wheel of samsara. I can give you the keys to unlock the prison door. If one can't do that, then better not to be a teacher, a parent, a marriage partner. Now, just think of the social effects if people would take this seriously. You would see an amazing shift in the world. Honestly, I don't know who I am. I don't know what I'm doing. Sorry, I can't take responsibility for you. I can't teach you. I can't parent you. I can't marry you. I can't be your partner. But I love you. Yeah, but what can I do for you? I don't know who I am. I have no ability to control my mind and senses. So you may say you love me, but what can I really do for you? This is real honesty. In this way, you'd actually see some human progress, irrespective of what the economy is doing. We just like to present these insights for your consideration. These social and cultural insights, which we feel are essential for the well-being of human society. So, anyway, those are some themes that we consider here. These are themes that we think deeply about, and we are dedicated to providing society with what we are quite sure is the greatest benefit. People are hungry, true, People need clothes, that's true. But if you can give people knowledge of why their immaterial existence in the first place and who they actually are, you get to the root of the problem. You give them clothes, and the clothes wear out. You give them food, they'll be hungry again later. But if you can give them knowledge of the self and how to control their mind and senses, that is the greatest welfare work, the greatest charity work, the greatest philanthropy. So this is how we see Krishna consciousness. Thank you very much. We'll ask if you have any questions. Otherwise, I think also we're after our guests dine sufficiently, we can also discuss more. Anyone have any questions? I know it's a lot to think about. Yes. Where what is originally from? Oh, I wouldn't say the color is pure. It's just different colors of cloth indicate different statuses in life. So those who are wearing what you call the peach color, it can go anywhere from peach to coral to apricot. They are not married. That can either mean two things. They're not married yet, or to a much lesser extent, they're not going to marry at all. So most of them that you see, in fact, I'd say 99% of those who you see wearing the peach or the apricot or the coral, they are in what is called in Sanskrit, the brahmachari phase of life. They're living as celibate monks, but they have the choice in the future whether they want to go into family life or not. In other words, they are in a trainee phase, and they're understanding that whether I go on as a monk or enter family life, let me lay the foundation now of being able to control my mind and senses. Then I can be of some value to a family if I enter family life later on. So most, I'll tell you, statistically, most will enter family life. But they're going through this trainee phase in order to gather control and mastery over themselves so they can actually be of benefit to their spouse and their children. Now, a very tiny percentage are what you might call specialists. Just like at a university or a college, very few at the college or university are professors. The vast amount of persons here are students. So similarly, very few of us have taken lifelong vows to remain single. Very few, maybe 1%. Many people don't know this. You know, they think, oh, they're all monks, and they none of them work. And the opposite is the truth. Maybe 1% have taken these vows. Why have they persons like me taken a vow of to be single all the life? Because we feel we want to make the whole world our family. I can travel all over the world and give talks like I'm doing now. I spent 8 years underground during the communist days in Europe. I couldn't do that if I had a family. But have no fear. Most will marry. Any other? That's a very good question. Yes.
Formerly, the knowledge that you're talking about comes from India. And Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, and
People would say, well, yeah, India has all this knowledge, but look at the poverty, look at the illiteracy, look at the state of affairs there. It's so third world, fourth world, fifth world, et cetera, et cetera. Now, suddenly, all of a sudden, the last 5 years, India has experienced a tremendous technological expansion into places like the Silicon Valley and the computers, and some of the most successful people in the world are now at the forefront of their fields, and Western money is pouring into India. All kinds of material goods are pouring into India, big screen TVs, cell phones. As a matter of fact, a friend of mine commented that MTV has done to India in 20 years what the British and moguls and others could not do in centuries. So if India, if this knowledge is so powerful, how is it that India is now following the lead of the Western countries and has not learned the experience of the Western countries with all of the problems that have followed all of our technological and economic success?
Yes, that's another very good question. By the way, this is Amarendra Das, and he's not a monk. He is a family man. He is an experienced lawyer. He even ran once for political office in Florida. So, India is a very interesting place. You have great polarization going on in India now. You have many people, out of the billion or so there, who are going towards what the West has already chewed and gotten a bellyache from. And you've got a lot of persons who are going increasingly into the spiritual direction. So what I see, and I've been to India probably 35 times in my life. That's enough to, I think, speak with some authority. What I see is two different directions happening at the same time. Some people are going one way. Bring it on, all the problems of the West disguised as benefits. Others are going another direction. Let's realize that we have the most important knowledge, the most lucid knowledge. Let's explore that more. So both things are happening at the same time, I would say. And it's going to be very interesting what the future will be. Things are going to be very, very interesting. And I think that the Krishna Consciousness Organization is uniquely positioned in order to deal with this coming paradox of India, which is going to affect the whole world. Outside of India, the Krishna Conscious Organization has experience in transplanting the ancient Vedic knowledge of India on foreign soil. So we can go both ways. We can deal with the Western world, and we can deal with life in India. This is a very advantageous position. And therefore, we're getting so many very bright and talented overseas students from India, or either studying for advanced degrees right here in Los Angeles, or they've recently completed their advanced studies, and simultaneously they're practicing Krishna consciousness because they see, I can be universal in this way. I can have the best of the West and the best of India at the same time. So we feel that our Krishna conscious society is rightly positioned on the cutting edge for the future. And I'm very happy to be a small part of that. When I was in my last month at Yale, I went to see my dean, and I still remember the conversation. I was telling him, you know, I don't see much future for myself in society as it is. And of course, this was 1972, you know, the tail end of the countercultural days. But my dean wasn't impressed at all. He wasn't shaken. He wasn't fazed. You know, he was right in the midst of so much turbulence amongst the students on the campus. But he kept his bearings. I told him, I don't see any future for myself in the way society is. He just looked at me without blinking his eyes and said, you are a Yale man. You will influence the world. Now, let me apologize. Your president graduated the year before I enrolled there. But anyway, yes, it looks like I am, in a small way, trying to influence the world. I've traveled on every continent for the past 25 years, traveled extensively. And yes, I do see certain trends, and I have very very interesting experiences behind the Iron Curtain during the communist days, also in communist China, when things were much more tense there. And I'm very convinced that Krishna consciousness has a powerful solution for the practical problems of human society. All right, I'll end there. Thank you very much.